From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Missing 411. David Pilatus joins us again as we talk more about people disappearing, simply vanishing. Here's what's happening. Well, the major story over the weekend, continuing the major story today, the Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, it is gone, disappeared. Details concerning this sudden Saturday disappearance of Flight 370 continues to trickle in. I'm going to read what has been going on today for you. Azahuddin Abdul Rahman, that's the head of Malaysia's Civil Aviation Authority. He said the missing Boeing 777 carrying 227 passengers presents an unprecedented mystery. Here's what we do know so far. The flight disappeared on Friday night into Saturday morning en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The plane was cruising at an altitude of 35,000 feet. And weather was more or less clear. Air traffic controllers in Vietnam say contact with the crew disappeared about 120 nautical miles east of the Malaysian town of Kota Bharu. Radar signals suggest the plane may have turned around before losing contact. And yet, nearly three whole days later, there are still no signs of the jet or its passengers, and an oil slick spotted in the South China Sea, originally thought to be a clue, turned out to be a false lead. Two Italian passengers said to be on board the flight turned out to be safe on the ground when they told authorities that their passports had in fact been stolen earlier. Someone aboard the flight was said to be using them, one of whom resembled a very famous soccer player. Adding another wrinkle to the case, the Wall Street Journal reports that the airliners, such as the Malaysian Jet, also carry emergency beacons to transmit the aircraft's location in the event of a mishap so that the rescue teams can reach the site. These beacons, called emergency locator devices, are activated by impact on land or water, along with other emergency communications equipment. Malaysia's aviation regulator said no signals were received from the flight. Naturally, conspiracy theories are now already flying left and right on social media. One theory suggests the plane's sudden disappearance is a false flag operation. Another claims that some relatives of the passengers on board have even reported hearing their phones ring, but no one is answering. Others have gone so far as to suggest that the plane simply vanished. If we never find the debris, writes one theorist, it means some entirely new, mysterious, and powerful force is at work on our planet, which can simply pluck airplanes out of the sky without leaving behind even a shred of evidence. And another just as bizarre theory suggests that terrorists hijacked the plane and have parked the plane intact in an abandoned hangar to use as a weapon of mass destruction in the future. Over at Reddit, speculation is surprisingly measured, says one user who claims to be a pilot. At 35,000 feet, he says, they'd be able to travel another 100 to 120 miles, far enough to reach the coast of Vietnam. Depending on the speed of the aircraft, it would take at least 15 to 30 minutes to reach the earth or the sea, giving them ample time to make a distress call. Throw in this weird stuff with the faked passports and now reports that the plane apparently had attempted to turn back. And this makes me, according to the pilot, think something pretty sudden, catastrophic, must have happened. And mechanical or pilot error seems unlikely in the case. In a moment, Jack Cashel will join us. He's going to be talking to us about this incredible case. Very low levels of radiation from the Fukushima nuclear disaster likely will reach ocean waters along the U.S. West Coast next month, according to scientists. Now, current models predict that the radiation will be extremely low levels that won't harm humans or the environment, according to a chemical oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute who presented the research on the issue last week. Now, he says, look, I'm not trying to be an alarmist here. We can make predictions, we can do models, but unless you have results, how will we know it's safe? Now, the news comes 3 years after the devastating Japanese tsunami and resulting nuclear accident. And a very strong earthquake rattled North California's coast and was widely felt across the region, but authorities said that there were no reports of injuries or damage. It was a magnitude 6.9. Let's check in with the expert on earthquakes, Cal Ori, her book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes. Cal, is this a prelude to the big one everybody's talking about?
Geologist Jim Berkland has always taught me that March and April are shaky months. Go back in history, the Great Alaska Earthquake, March 27th, with the tsunami that actually killed people in Crescent City, Northern California. And then we have the San Francisco earthquake, 1906, April 18th. It was a surprise. We've been in a seismic drought for a long time in California. There wasn't a lot of damage. They said we dodged a bullet, just like they did back in 2010 on January 9th when they had a 6.5. It could be a prelude. It could be a foreshock without a doubt. It's in an area of the Cascadia subduction zone, which can definitely give us a 9.0 and a tsunami. No doubt.
So it's coming pretty soon, Cal, isn't it?
It could. It could come this year. I wouldn't be surprised. Would I bet my Aussie puppy on it? Maybe not.
All right, Cal, thank you so much. Scientists have identified four new man-made gases that are contributing to the depletion, they say, of the ozone layer. Two of the gases are accumulating at a rate that is causing concern among researchers. Worries over the growing ozone hole have been seen the production of the CFC gases restricted since the 1980s. The precise origin of these new substances remains a mystery, say the scientists. They say, though, that blocking, of course, the ozone layer getting through will cause cancers in humans and reproductive problems in humans and in animals. Two drivers were stung by more than 600 bees following a two-vehicle car crash into a tree in California. The two women drivers involved in the two-vehicle crash were stung at least 600 times. The bees stung three people, a deputy who came to help the two women. It was an unbelievable story. Can you imagine? And neighbors, by the way, all over the place couldn't go out of their houses because of these bees everywhere. A California man who lost $500,000 in 17 hours gambling at a Las Vegas casino was so drunk he could not remember the episode after waking up in his hotel room, according to a lawsuit that's been filed on his behalf that seeks to erase the debt. The 52-year-old man was at the casino, said he was piled with free alcoholic drinks while he gambled away, and claims that he doesn't remember anything. What's up in the skies these days? Let's check in with the astronomer, Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Stephen, what's new?
Oh, George, good to be with you. Always so many amazing things to look at. And here's some tips for sky watchers here for GHOST. If you look tonight and into early tomorrow morning, the moon just passed its first quarter phase. Makes for some great photographs. Also, you can learn about many of the Apollo landing sites with a small telescope. But, George, the planetary sky show continues to get great. For the good part of the United States and North America, the planet Mars now high in the southeastern part of the sky. It actually gets closest to us during early April. And what's happening on the surface of Mars, George, right now, is that we're seeing a lot of dust storms on the surface of Mars. These, believe it or not, are visible with many small to large telescopes. And, George, with all the great activity out there with people with these CCD cameras, there's so much to see. No major meteor showers to report right now. But always keep your eyes to the skies. March is full of fireball activity. And finally, George, the sun still pumping out tremendous sunspots. But
sure
fortunate
is.
For the Earth, no major X flares at this time. But I think things are probably about to change, don't you think?
Keep watching those skies for us, Stephen. Appreciate it. Up next, Jack Ashel joins us. One of his books, First Strike, TWA Flight 800, and the Attack on America. He's going to chat with us about this unbelievable story of this missing plane. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Jack Ashel, of course, is an Emmy Award-winning writer, documentary producer. He has a Ph.D. in American Studies from Purdue and is taught as a Fulbright professor in France. He, of course, is the co-author of First Strike, TWA Flight 800 and the attack on America. Jack, first of all, thank you for joining us on this late notice. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure, George. Thanks for having me on the show.
This has some strange similarities to TWA Flight 800, except in that case, we found parts of the plane and everything else. In this case, this plane is gone. I can't explain it. How about you?
Well, you know, when I've been watching the debate on this, in fact, I was watching this thing on CNN this evening, they all overlook the obvious, and that is you begin with this premise. It's either one of two things. It's either an unprecedented mystery, as the Malaysian officials say, or, inferring to the best explanation, someone's withholding evidence. In other words, there's all of this evidence that might be there, you know, including, you know, satellite imagery, the radar data, the visual floating debris. The stuff floats. It doesn't sink. I mean, at least some elements of it always float. You know, all the kinds of things they might have used. The emergency locator that goes off when there's an impact crash that you mentioned earlier. The black boxes that will ping for 30 days. If none of these things exist, or so we're told, the most likely explanation seems to me, George, that we're not being told about their existence. And here's the parallel to TWA Flight 800. Flight 800 went down off the coast of Long Island, just only 10 miles offshore, in the summer of 1996 in July. The crash was on July 17th. The black boxes were not discovered until July 25th, 8 days later.
That's right.
This is 150 feet of water, 10 miles off the coast, you know, and within sight of Steven Spielberg's house. And when they find them, and I've seen the video of their being found, you know, the black boxes, you know, as you know, are orange, they're sitting right out on the ocean floor, which suggests that someone got the black boxes, examined the black boxes, then developed a narrative around what the information contained in those boxes was, and then found them. I suspect that's what's going on here. I mean, that would seem to be the most rational and the least crazy explanation as for what happened.
What about the beacons, Jack? The beacons that haven't apparently gone on, or do you think they did go on?
Well, see, that's what we don't know. I mean, we're being told that they didn't go on. We're being told that there's no debris field that's been found. You know, we really take this on faith. If this stuff had been found, the Malaysian authorities, especially given the fact that this plane is going to Beijing, and that Malaysia is, an international hotbed of terrorism, and they have every reason to want to get the evidence as it exists, if need be, doctor the evidence, and to establish a narrative before everything is found. Now, I'm theorizing just like everyone else is. It just seems to me my theory is more grounded in reality than the ones I've been hearing on TV or reading in the newspaper, you know?
Jack, the fact that there's nothing, there's no evidence of the plane anywhere, I mean, it's just gone. Is that unusual? I mean, if let's look at a couple scenarios here based on the story that I just read at the top of the show. If let's say a missile hit it, there'd be debris all over the place, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, because, like, for instance, when they say to you, in case of a water landing, you know, grab your seat cushion, well, they float, you know, and they'd be on the surface. The insulation from the plane would be floating, and certain parts, other parts, the seats might be floating. When the 800 went down, there was an easily, clearly visible debris field that stretched for miles. And when it was smoking, a lot of it was smoking for the first 24, 36, 48 hours. So it's not in that remote a part of the world. There's a lot of people who live around there, you know. It's the South China Sea. I don't know how they couldn't have found it.
Is it conceivable that the plane just went down in its entirety, did not break up, and it's just sitting on the bottom of the sea?
I mean, you know, there's a precedent for that, too, and that was that Egypt Air flight, where it was sort of the pilot suffered a case of, you know, sudden jihadi syndrome and downed the plane.
He dove it down to himself, yeah.
Yeah. And that would make it harder because that would explain several other things. All the missing evidence, including the most obvious piece of missing evidence, George, is the distress signal from the cockpit, which allegedly never came either. So
Right.
Again, if we go back to just the basics, we have these half a dozen variables that should have alerted authorities to the presence of the, you know, the location of the remains of the airplane. They're all missing, which suggests to me the most likely explanation is that we're simply not being told about the evidence that has been found.
The radar reports showed that the plane may have started to turn to come back to Kuala Lumpur. If that's the case, aren't pilots required to say, hey, you know what, I'm changing course, I'm coming back, even before they do it?
You would think, and yet you have the prototype here of U.S. Air 93, the one that crashed over Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where that turned fully. You know, went out towards Cleveland and turned and made a turn, and no one said anything because they've been hijacked. So that is the only scenario, it strikes me, that if the pilots no longer had control of the cockpit, they would validate that thesis. Otherwise, if they're turning around, sure, they're going to say, hey, Mac, we got a problem. We're turning around.
Our special guest this hour, Jack Hashel, author of First Strike, TWA Flight 800, and the Attack on America. This story, when I heard about it, Jack, I was in Greensboro, North Carolina. I had an affiliate speech before a number of just great coast-to-coast guests, and I heard about this. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, again, the fact that there is just seems to be no information publicly coming to us, I find to be extremely strange. What about these two folks who have stolen passports? I mean, does that add to the plot?
Yeah, I think so. I think it does. It seems to me that it's not at all inconceivable that if you have two mystery people on board with stolen passports that they acquired in Thailand, which is, you know, when it's like the Casablanca of our day, a place where international terrorists convene and, you know, exchange things. But it seems to me that the possibility that one or both of them was some form of underwear or shoe bomber or whatever would be likely. You know, I mean, I was watching CNN, George, and they were saying, oh, maybe they were just drug dealers. Well, yeah, but the plane blew up. You know, what were they, cooking meth on plane?
Yeah, exactly.
What's going on, you know?
Walter White on the plane, for crying out loud. Well, you know, I fly a lot, Jack, and I can only imagine the horror of the people who are on the plane. Now, it went down in the wee hours, so I would assume a lot of them were asleep when whatever happened quickly. But for a plane to go down that fast, one of two things have had to have happened, as far as I'm concerned, with no communication, and that is a missile strike from the outside, which some people are theorizing, or an explosion from within. It's one or the other.
I would say you're right. At that altitude, 36,000 feet, 35,000 feet, it wasn't, we can, I think, safely say it wasn't like a handheld man pad or anything.
No.
It would have had to have been some sort of major naval operation.
What about the North Koreans? What about the North Koreans, Jack? I mean, there's talk that they have launched. China has warned them before. Your missiles are getting too close to passenger planes. What about the possibility that something like that happened?
I wouldn't rule it out. The location makes it less likely. That is in the South China. But, you know, what I haven't heard enough about is whether there are any naval exercises going on in that part of the world. And if so, who was doing them? Now, for your audience, George, and I will say this right up front, I'm as disinclined to conspiracy theories as anyone I know. It's almost inevitable. I mean, the odds are overwhelming that TWA Flight 800 was taken down by our own Navy accidentally.
By mistake, and that's right.
And if anyone wants to, there's a very good documentary that came out this past summer, just called TWA Flight 800, by Tom Stalkup and Christina Borgeson. I wasn't involved with it, but I know the principals. And, you know, Borgeson used to work for 60 Minutes, and Stalkup is a, you know, career physicist who's dedicated his life to this crash. It's on Netflix. It's available on Netflix, very popular on Netflix, and it's very well done. They had six high-level people involved in the investigation come forward, whistleblowers, six, you know, from the FBI, from the NTSB, TWA. And they all told the same story, that this the investigation had been skewed from the beginning, that they were allowed to find only one possible explanation, and that was mechanical failure. And I've talked to, you know, personally, I've talked to at least a score of the eyewitnesses. There are 270 that talked to the FBI about the likelihood of a missile strike on TWA Flight 800. But then again, that plane was only about 13,000 feet, which
that's right. That's close enough.
Jack,
stay with us.
36,000 feet. Yeah.
We're going to be right back with you. We're going to take some phone calls. We'll continue talking about the both TWA Flight 800 and this Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And Jack Cashel with us this hour as we talk about this very strange disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. He's the author of First Strike, TWA Flight 800 and the Attack on America. We're going to take your calls with Jack in a moment, too, when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Jack Cashel with us. We'll take your calls in a second. Jack, the one thing that puzzles me, the radar report of the plane turning around. Now, if it were hit by a missile, I don't think he'd have time to try to turn around. How do we explain that?
You know, that's one of those bits of information, George, that is floated out there without much validation. I'm a little hesitant to... you know, to buy into that, because that just, you're right, it takes several variables for that to be true. One is that it wasn't hit by a missile, otherwise there's no turning around, or it wasn't
that's
blown
right.
up by a bomb, you know, or there's no turning around. And then also that there was no, that we know of, no word out of the cockpit, which would almost inevitably have preceded a rational turning around. Unless, the only possibility, it would seem as if the cockpit had been taken over, either by, you know, external hijackers or by, you know, a deranged pilot himself. But that still doesn't account for the disappearance of the plane.
Precisely. Now, with all this that's been going on, the one thing a terrorist likes, Jack, and you know this and I know this, is they love the publicity after the tragic event. So far, nobody said anything. They haven't come forward. They haven't, you know, taken credit for something like this. I mean, that's why they do this, in order to let the world know we did it, we can do it, and that's the way it is. A terrorist does not want us to think that this was a mechanical failure or something like that. Where are they?
Well, that raises the other issue, George, and that is, if they were saying anything, would we know? Who would they be telling it to? What it's not, well, they're certainly not doing it on Twitter. I think we could say that. But, for instance, Ansar al-Sharia, the group that took credit for the attack on the consulate in Benghazi, was all over Twitter within a couple hours of the attack. I mean, so they were definitely taking credit for it in a way that could not be edited by any authority. If this group, if there is someone trying to take credit, it seems to me they have enough vehicles now through the social media to get beyond any kind of editorial screen by Malaysian officials or by anyone else. So that's possible. But then again, if there were, let's say there were Uyghurs out in Western China, the ones who were responsible for the knife attack last week, the horrific knife attack that killed like 27 people, and they're Islamic also, they'd have a hard time getting that news out of China. You know?
Well, there's no question
and they
about
may,
it.
You know, and they may also not want to call attention to themselves. I mean, given the capability of the Chinese state to rain terror down on their province.
I mean, all these pieces of the puzzle, Jack, just don't make sense. The two phony passports, the stolen passports, the beacon that never went on, the radar report of him coming back. I mean, none of this makes any sense.
No, in fact, the only explanation to me that makes sense now, given the fact that we have a half a dozen variables that we should be aware of but we're not, is that we're simply not being told the whole story.
That's right.
That, to me, makes the most sense. That's the least conspiratorial observation I can make about what happened to that plane.
And if we're not being told the whole story, why? And with TWA Flight 800, let's talk about that, too, for a moment. Why weren't we told that real story? Because of panic? Because of the airline panic?
Yeah, it's 2 days before the Atlanta Olympics, you know, for starters. And if it were revealed that a United States regular passenger jet on the way to Paris was blown out of the skies just 12 minutes out of Manhattan, out of JFK, rather, Yeah, it could have ended the Olympics. It could have shut down passenger traffic on the East Coast. And that's just the national security explanation. There is political explanations as well. And so what happened is that we took that, the prototype of TWA Flight 800, and that is, the government changed a clear attack on that airplane, inadvertent or otherwise, into a mechanical failure. Sometime later, about 5 years later, something happened in Thailand, which is, again, close to home here, and that is a plane blew up on the tarmac. It was a 737. And the NTSB, our National Transportation Safety Board, and the FBI involved themselves in that explanation. This, by the way, the plane blew up just minutes before the beleaguered Prime Minister of Thailand was supposed to board, who had been involved in a major corruption scandal and was about to rat out all his buddies in the government. Right?
Go figure.
And initially, everyone said it was sounding like a bomb. Everyone thought it was a bomb. Well, it was still sitting on the runway. He hadn't yet boarded. And then after the NTSB was finished with it, it was another mechanical failure, just like TWA Flight 800, sitting on the overheated runway, fumes built up, spark hits, blah, blah, blah. Well, unfortunately, George, and I wish it were otherwise, because I'm a otherwise believing citizen of the United States, we have no reason to trust the authorities in this case, either ours and certainly not theirs. If you're in Kuala Lumpur, for instance, which the critical planning meeting for 9/11 took place in Kuala Lumpur. There's a lot of reasons for them to try to get their story straight.
Yeah.
Especially if someone from that airport or someone in that country blew up a plane filled with Chinese citizens. You know, I mean, China's breathing down their back. I have a feeling they're scrambling right now to find a story that works, that doesn't get them in major, major trouble.
No question about it. Just one of those stories. I don't know if we'll ever get the answer to this. Maybe one day, Jack, but it's going to take a long time. Let's go to some phone calls for you. We'll go east of the Rockies. Terrence is in Atlanta, Georgia. Terrence, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing today, George? I'm first-time caller, long-time listener.
Thanks, Terrence.
Right, this situation reminds me of the old Twilight Zone episode, and their plane went back in time. Maybe the plane went to another dimension or something like that.
let me tell you something, Terrence. As bizarre and as far-fetched as that may seem at this point, who knows anymore? I mean, Jack, I'm getting emails from people saying it was swallowed up by a massive UFO and it's gone. I mean,
well, you know, I tell you what, if we're to believe that all of that other evidence does not exist, well, then, I'm going back in time or getting swallowed by UFO makes as much sense as any other theory out there.
Yeah. it really does. Now, do you think boarding planes with stolen passports in that neck of the woods is a commonplace occurrence?
Well, apparently they don't screen, and it shouldn't have been that hard to screen for. I mean, that's one extra step on every passenger ID, though. You'd have to look up his database to see if it was if that passport had been stolen. Two guys got on board that way, presumably. So I would say picking up passports in a place like Thailand, which is where they got them, they went to Thailand to get them. So there must be a cottage industry there of stealing and fabricating passports. It's probably relatively common, and it's obviously not checked for, at least not yet. It may be in the future.
First-time caller, Susan, Brandenburg, Kentucky. Susan, welcome to Coast to Coast, and you are on the air with us. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, George. This is such a great honor. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Go ahead.
I had an idea. What if, and it's kind of far-fetched, but what if there is like a Bermuda Triangle-type place right where this plane was flying?
Well, that's another one of those strange theories, Mr. Cashel.
Yes.
Yeah, if you look at what happened in the Bermuda Triangle, what is that, half a dozen of our planes disappeared in, was it 1945, as did the plane that was sent to look for them without any trace. So there are parts of the world that do seem to be spooked that way, that, seem to have a particular hex on airplanes. In fact, my own cousin, the guy after whom I'm named, his name is John Rogers, my official name is John Rogers Cashel, was a Marine fighter pilot in World War II who, and his whole squadron disappeared in the South Pacific, not too far from there. So it can happen.
We go to Mike, truck driving in Iowa on the wild card line. Hey, Mike, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Good evening, gentlemen. I've got a theory.
All right.
Let's say I'm a terrorist, and I commandeer this aircraft, and we turn it around, and we drop down out of sight, out of radar. We black it out, and we have some compadres down there in South Vietnam at an abandoned airstrip, light it up, we land it, we get the passengers off. We load it up with a nuke, and we put the passengers back on, and we get it back up in the air, and we arm the nuke, and then we try to negotiate with somebody, maybe LAX, to let us down. And then if we detonate the nuke over L.A., great. And if we don't and they shoot us down, we've still got a nuclear event and all the fallout. Where it's positioned, you know, China's not going to cooperate. They're not going to let us send a team in if it's on the ground. They're not going to do it. Hell, they might have supplied the nuke. Where's Bruce Willis when you need him, you know, yippee-ki-yay.
Yeah. You got it. Mike, let me tell you, that's a theory that you can't discount at this point at all. Jack, let me ask you this, too, in terms of the flying of the plane and, you know, where the radar especially. How low does that plane have to go before it falls off radar? Because I haven't heard them talk about that.
Well, as I understand it, they follow the radar typically with the transponder, and the transponder not only tells them where the plane is, but tells them which plane it is. So when you see those little numbers moving across a air traffic controller screen, that's right. That's what they're following. But they can do this though: is that if they turn the transponder off, or if they, you know, somehow neutralize it, they can skin paint it. That is, they could follow the outline of it, like the ghostly outline of it, even without the transponder on. And they should have been able to do that. You know, they shouldn't have lost it. You know, they should have been able to find it.
Well, is that what happened? It fell off the radar. The blip just disappeared.
Yeah, and that's what happened with TWA Flight 800. All of a sudden, you know, as they said, that the air traffic controllers in the case of Flight 800 were the first ones to alert the authorities that something was amiss, because they saw, as they said, the FAA said, they saw an unknown object merging with TWA Flight 800, and then it just disappeared from the screen. But even as it disappeared, the fragmentation of it left a trackable radar path, so they could tell which way the debris shot out, for instance. So that should have all been available. And they record all that. I mean, so it should, you know, it's not like it goes and it's gone. I mean, this is like a security camera. You know, they always access it. And in the case of TWA Flight 800, even before the eyewitness reports started coming in, the FAA immediately sent that data down to its headquarters, and first went to Atlantic City and then to Washington, D.C. So they called that night in the Situation Room, and the only one who talks about this openly is Richard Clark, who is then the anti-terror czar.
Yeah.
But he convened an emergency meeting in the Situation Room of the White House that lasted all night. They didn't do that for any other plane crash during the Clinton era. In fact, I don't think they've ever done it for an American plane crash anywhere. Certainly not for the Value Jet crash that occurred just a few months earlier in Florida. So they knew something was up immediately. And I'm sure they knew that night what happened. Just like I suspect that the Malaysian authorities know what happened. And I think what they are doing, and I could be wrong, but my theory strikes me as the most grounded in reality, is that they're examining the available evidence, including the boxes, or looking for them. They probably found them by now. And either trying to comprehend them and tell a story about what they tell, or to, in fact, like they did in TWA Flight 800, to doctor them so that the story that someone else might want to tell is untellable.
Now, in this particular case, if it was shot down by a missile from North Korea or some terrorist or a bomb from within, what's the motive for withholding the information, Jack?
Well, it depends on if there was a missile strike, it most likely was inadvertent, and it was most likely done as a result of some naval exercise. And if that's the case, they may have been testing new missile capabilities. Could have been China itself. And in that case, that's not information, just like with TWA Flight 800, where we were testing, you know, new missiles. It's not information we would have wanted to share in any case, even if there weren't a huge embarrassment, you know, a huge national embarrassment involved.
Are these like heat-seeking missiles? So, you know, obviously, if a missile is going to hit a jet like that, it's guided toward it somehow.
Yeah, it is guided towards it. I don't know if it seeks heat. There's different kinds, but and usually the explosion is on the exterior. They don't usually hit. You know, they're proximity, you know, missiles typically. So they blow up, you know, in immediate proximity to the plane.
Concussion gets the plane, right?
Right, destroys it. And it, at that altitude, you know, 35,000 feet, passengers aren't going to live more than 15 seconds no matter what, you know, because of the rapid decompression.
Oh,
of the, you know, 70, 80 degrees below zero, whatever it is, that, you know, that high. So it's...
it's got to be the worst feeling.
No
oh,
chance.
My God. Oh, my.
I mean, you don't get to feel it too long, you know.
No, you don't. It's just that, heck, you know, I've been on a plane before, Jack, when, you know, you fall asleep and you wake up to some minor turbulence, and it's a jolting feeling. You can only imagine what these poor people went through.
Yes, especially if they had that 30 to 60-second window where they realized that their lives were over.
Would the black boxes, if and when they get discovered, if they haven't already, have the voices of the pilots probably screaming?
Yeah, there's two black boxes, and one is you know, the cockpit voice recorder, and the other is the data recorder, the flight data recorder. And I imagine that the pilots were saying what pilots always say. You know what the number one word is at the time of an airplane crash?
Yeah, we do.
It begins with S and ends with T. I mean, that's what people say when they're confronted with inevitability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's see if we'll grab another call here for you.
Sure.
We'll go to Tim in Seattle. Go ahead, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Yeah, I'm just calling. I was actually involved with four jet crashes. Three of them were the top 10 single plane crashes in aviation history. That Egypt Air flight, I had worked on a system on the tail that was faulty, and I had told Boeing about it. Boeing let it go anyway. I had a whistleblower lawsuit against Boeing, and with the statement with the whistleblower lawsuit, I described the Egypt Air crash 2 years before it happened.
Well, you were spot on. Look, Tim, listen, you were spot on. We're running out of time here, Jack, and I just want to thank you for your expertise. Jack, I suspect we're going to have you come back as soon as we find any more information on this flight. So just be available over the next week or two, my friend, okay?
Hey, George, great show. Thanks for having me, and it's my pleasure anytime, okay?
Jack Cashel, of course, author of First Strike, TWA Flight 800, and the attack on America, as he reacts to this very bizarre story of the missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Whatever happened to it? Who knows right now? But a story we'll continue to follow as well right here on Coast to Coast AM. Up next, another story of missing people. This will boggle your mind. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.